What if I told you that there's a cure for chronic pain? Yes, for that pain you were told you would just have to manage. And what if I told you that that cure is already inside of you? Would you believe me? Welcome to the Let's Talk Mind Body Healing podcast, where we talk about how to truly alleviate chronic suffering. I'm your host, Melissa Jaramus, and this is episode number 26. And in this episode, I speak with Vanessa Blackstone, who is the executive director and also a psychotherapist at the Pain Psychology Center. And Vanessa may be one of the more, I guess, bigger names that I've had on the show so far. So the Pain Psychology Center is home to Alan Gordon's pain reprocessing therapy. And obviously the now pretty infamous tool of somatic tracking. So it was a real pleasure to speak with Vanessa, and she brings a real wealth of experience and wisdom to this episode, including her very own chronic pain recovery. So stay tuned to hear another amazing recovery journey and also to hear in great detail all about pain reprocessing therapy straight from the source. A quick little update on me. So I hosted my very first free community meditation event last month. It went really well. The first time I've led a meditation since giving birth to my son 13 months ago. So I was a little nervous, but it went well. And this month I hope to host at least another workshop. Really hoping to build some community awareness around mind-body healing. But that it's quite challenging given the paradigm shift, as I'm sure anybody listening is aware of. And I have lots of nerves and lots of feelings of imposter syndrome going on at the moment. All part of this messy part of being human. Anyway, I won't talk too long. We'll get on to the episode. Wishing you all a really lovely March, and I'll talk to you again next month. I am a provisional psychologist with my PhD or my doctorate in education, but I'm not a medical doctor. So all of the content that I provide about mind-body healing in any medium, including but not limited to this podcast and my social media channels, is for informational purposes only. No content provided by me is intended to be a substitute for professional medical advice. The purpose is to promote broad understanding and knowledge of various health topics. If you choose to use any information provided by me, you do so solely at your own risk. Always seek the guidance of your doctor or other qualified health professional with any questions you may have regarding your health or medical condition. Do not embark on a mind-body healing journey until you have the clearance from your healthcare practitioner to do so, until you have discussed how to apply mind-body healing to your own individual case. The methods discussed by guests on the show are not necessarily endorsed by me.
Welcome to Let's Talk Mind Body Healing podcast. I'm your host, Felicia Jaramus, and today I have the amazing pleasure of speaking with Vanessa Blackstone, who is the executive director at the Pain Psychology Center. So that's pretty impressive, Vanessa. Pain Psychology Center, I say, is pretty famous in the mind body space. So maybe could you start by telling us a little bit about yourself and how you came to want to work in the mind body healing space?
Yeah, happy to. So when I started off in this field, I first off had a lot of my own chronic pain symptoms.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm a type A person who's really good at powering through. So at the time, none of that mattered. I just knew that I wanted to be in school, focus as much as I could to be successful, and that meant not stopping along the way. So initially my main focus was in mindfulness-based work. I was supposed to be going into a PhD program to research mindfulness-based relapse prevention, which is for substance use and recovery, and actually quite similar to pain reprocessing
Yes,
therapy.
similar relapse.
Yeah, a bit of a cousin of mindfulness-based stress reduction, right? So in the same repertoire, but with a different set of clients to focus on. And during this time of pursuing this focus, ultimately going into a PhD program, like I said, I'd just been dealing with a lot of my own chronic pain symptoms. I'm one of those people like Alan, who is our founder of PRT, Pain Reprocessing Therapy, and the founder of the Pain Psychology Center. Like Alan, have had so many different kinds of symptoms that it feels so hard to make sense of all of them through this perspective. You know, we are all incredibly unique people, but our symptoms and where they come from are not unique in the slightest, unfortunately. But when it feels so complex to you, it feels like the treatment is going to be complex. So it's definitely one of those people that like just had so much going on that I didn't even know where to start. And so during the time of graduate school and focusing on MBRP, I was kind of hitting a wall with a lot of my own symptoms. I have had chronic migraines since I was 11. It was initially thought to be a hormonal shift leading to menstrual migraines, then went into vestibular migraines, and then went into, well, now the neck pain from the stress of school or being on the computer for too long was seeping up your neck and causing the migraines. And then now it was the migraines. Well, now they make you nauseous and dizzy. So that's what's happening. And then menstruation was then said to cause like all these really, really unbearable like pelvic floor pains that then led to before menstruation, well, now during, and then now after, and then all that, and all the medications was said to then cause IBS. Well, okay, but then all the medications were then said to cause chronic hives. So I had a lot of stuff going on, amongst maybe a few other things in there. And when I was in this grad school program, it was at its peak. And so, like I said, like a true type A person, I just wanted to grin and bear it, to white knuckle it, and to get through. And my thought, distorted thought, was that if I could just get through grad school and get into this PhD program, that I'd feel better. That's all I kept thinking. It's like, if I can just get through all of this stuff, I'll be fine. It's because of this stuff that I feel this way. So if I can just get through it. But of course, we don't just get through it. I was like a 4.0 student. I was like the president of the Honor Society. I had one of the best internships that you can get in the program. I was a research assistant, and I was in school full-time, working full-time, and working towards my PhD. So I hit a wall when I graduated, and I asked my grandfather, who's my mentor, if this is something that I needed to keep doing, because I wasn't sure if I wanted to. And he pretty much encouraged me to just defer on a PhD program, which is a really, really hard decision, and just focus on myself. And I thought that would make it feel better, and it didn't. I felt so much worse. I had the worst panic attack of my life after graduation. And it's just not knowing what I wanted to do. I was no longer in any school program. I wasn't working towards anything, so I thought, and felt awful. And I connected with a mentor of mine, who was a previous supervisor at the internship that, or the practicum that I had my last year. And this mentor slash previous supervisor had just gone to a talk that Alan was at. And when her and I got together, and I was, you know, letting her know that I don't really know where I want to go, but I just need time to kind of figure out what direction it is that I wanted to head in, she said, "Well, you know, I know that you've had all these chronic pain symptoms." She was talking to me about the work that she learned from Alan about pain reprocessing therapy at this kind of a conference that he led, or event. I can't remember what it was, but she was relaying some of it to me as someone that would, you know, receive the work well as a client, but then also was saying, like, "I know that Alan is hiring, so you might want to reach out because I think it'd be really good for you." And I didn't know anything about chronic pain work. I mean, I've worked with folks in recovery, and like maybe that's a little similar, I thought at the time, but I knew nothing about what to do with clients in chronic pain. And to be totally transparent, I thought that it would be kind of boring at the time. I thought that like working with addicts in recovery was more riveting, but I don't think I realized that I was kind of burnt out from working in that space. And so when I connected with Alan, and when I connected with the team here at the time and kind of pursued an interview, the more that I dove into this work, you know, just kind of researching before you have an interview, you know, you look everything up so that you show that you're interested in the company kind of thing. When I started reading it, I started having these aha moments where I was like, oh, wow, I can really identify with these personality traits. And oh, that's weird, because I have a symptom kind of like that, but I don't think it's the same. And I always kept trying to kind of find ways in which I didn't relate. But it was like, the more that I read it, the information was just pulling me in of like, we were talking to you.
There's always the but though, isn't there?
I was always the but person. Oh, but that's not like, I don't have back pain. And I just kept doing that to myself until I finally met with them in an interview. And this was with Alan and with Christy Weepy. She was the co-executive director at the time, and did my interview. And she's now has her own practice and the host of the Like Mind, Like Body podcast. But I had my interview with them, and it just felt good. It felt good to be in this kind of space. But I was also terrified at the same time. Long story short there, I got hired. I've been here since 2018. A couple of years ago, maybe two or three, I was promoted into the position of supervision director, and then co-executive director, and then executive director. And now we've been here in this really nice space where I've realized that this is actually my calling, and something that I feel really passionate about is this population. I've recovered from all of my own symptoms, and just like heading into this really cool direction where we're realizing that there's something to this work, that it's pretty powerful.
What an amazing story you've got.
Thank you.
Well done. And it must feel so good to have found your passion in life.
Yeah. Yeah, it is. I enjoy this work so much. It's interesting, you know, I think we talk a lot about like what work is supposed to be, you know, and how you're supposed to have a work-life balance, and I don't know. I've had people ask me like, oh, you do a lot, because I do a lot. I have a lot on my schedule, and like, you do a lot. I'm like, I do, but I don't. And people have asked like, but what's your work-life balance? And I'm like, I don't know how to answer those questions, because I know that I do a lot, but it doesn't physically feel like I do a lot. And I make time for my life in between and before and after my work. And there's just something about the fact that it feels so good to be here, that I don't really feel like I have to balance work and life. I don't feel like there has to be a clear line, because it doesn't feel clear to me, because it all feels like it goes hand in hand, because this has been a part of my life and my own healing and my own recovery. So yeah, it just doesn't feel like work. And if it does feel like work, that's usually my cue to take care of myself. Use that more of like as an opportunity to use the work that I preach about, rather than use it as a sign that like, oh, you're working too much. I like what I do, and I enjoy it a lot.
Yeah, it sounds like you're embodying that. It was the mantra. If you like what you do, you'll never work a day in your life. That's what it sounds like.
Totally. Oh, I love when cheesy mantras just really land. It's so good. I love when something like that is so relatable. You say it and you want that to be your thing, but it's funny. It's just like pain. Christy says something. She said something once where she says that, I'm going to get it wrong. She said that, oh, you won't know the moment that you're out of pain.
Yes.
And I have a lot of clients that hate that, but it's true, right?
It's
Like
true,
as a
because
recover, it's so
you have to
true.
not care about it anymore and like not be looking for it to go away.
Totally. Absolutely. And I feel like that mantra about work, you won't know the moment until you're there because you're not working towards like about you're not working towards making sure that you love this work. It just happens, you know? And it's like relaxing. You don't try to relax. You just relax. The more that you try, the
Relax.
harder that it is.
Okay, so let's get stuck in and talk more about the work that you do. So can you tell me, actually, maybe something you said earlier, you said our symptoms are not unique in the slightest in terms of where they come from. So can you elaborate more on that and on the Pain Psychology Center's approach to pain and
Absolutely. When I talk about like our symptoms feeling incredibly unique and complex, but not in an invalidating way, but just to say, well, they're not. What I'm trying to highlight is that our symptoms and our journey of trying to figure out how to solve them has felt so complex for so long. There's so many layers to what we're experiencing, so many people that have told us so many different things. That it can become really scary because you have been told over and over again that your case is complex, it's unique, it's mysterious, that it's going to take so many different things to manage, negate, decrease, whatever word you want to use, all of these kinds of symptoms. That I watch my own clients and every client that reaches out to the Pain Psychology Center get this message more and more that they're this big hot mess. And what I like to tell my clients is that you're not, because your brain, as beautiful and interwoven and complicated as it is, has some pretty simple systems to them that just send confusing messages. That's all. And so what we're trying to do is understand why your brain is sending you that message from a perspective that regulates that nervous system that is sending the signals in the first place. So essentially, what we're doing in pain reprocessing therapy is teaching the brain to unlearn sensations of pain or other sensory symptoms, maybe some symptoms that might feel a little bit more abstract, like migraines or IBS. What we're trying to do is teach the brain that these signals that it continues to send to the body are not always being sent for the reasons that you think they are. What we're doing as human beings is just trying to survive. And in our attempt to survive, we don't realize that out of fear, we can often unintentionally make these things more complicated. But when we back up a little bit and understand the role of the nervous system, take time to reprocess the sensations that we're getting to our body, it gives us a chance to actually look at these things through a different lens. When again, we've been looking at it understandably, through a lens of danger for many, many years until we can find something like pain reprocessing therapy that actually gives us permission to stop anxiously searching for an answer because we found it. It's our nervous system.
So, can you tell me a little bit more about what's involved in pain reprocessing therapy? So, what are the kind of elements?
Yeah, absolutely. So it is a system of psychological techniques that we use here that retrain the brain to interpret and respond to signals from the body properly, subsequently breaking this cycle, right? So in PRT, that's the acronym, pain reprocessing therapy, we have five main components. We have psychoeducation, right? We want to educate about the brain's origins and the reversibility of pain. The next one is just gathering and reinforcing the more personalized evidence for the brain's origin and that reversibility of pain. Right? Then the third one is attending to and appraising these pain sensations through a lens of safety, right? So by understanding them, we can actually attend to them differently. Addressing other emotional threats. Right. Other things may be at bay for why we're feeling so physically unsafe in our bodies. And we all go through stressful things in our lives. We've been through a lot, right? We take the time to try to understand that to make sense of, well, why might you be getting these signals? And then the last one is gravitating to positive feelings and sensations. Right? So now that we've understood why we get these signals and taught ourselves that it's possible to respond to them differently, now we have permission to start gravitating towards looking at these sensations long term through a different lens.
So you keep saying through a different lens. So are we talking about through a lens of safety or something else?
Yeah, we're talking about looking at these sensations through a lens of safety. You know, I think that the biggest thing that I notice within myself and with the clients that I work with is that we've spent a lot of times at looking at our body like a place of danger, like we can't trust it. But you can't like take your body off and switch it off for a new one. The way that I like to remind my own clients of what we're trying to do here is think about it this way. It's like we're going to couples therapy for you and your body. Something happened, right?
That's a good
Maybe
one.
Like, I know, right? Maybe like it feels like your body cheated on you or something. I don't know, or lied to you, right? But you can't like divorce it. You're kind of stuck with it. So if you're stuck with it and we can't take it off and switch it out for a new one, we have to work with it, right? We have to work with our body and work with our brain to reinterpret sensations through that lens of safety, because you might be getting them because maybe you don't trust this system that you're in, right? I know that like my biggest thing was having a really hard time feeling like yet another thing wasn't going to happen. Because I've had so many of those symptoms that are like really differ from each other. You know, like pelvic floor pain is very different from migraines. And it just felt like it all kept happening. You know, IBS is very different from chronic hives. It just felt like one thing after another kept happening. And I think the biggest part of pain reprocessing therapy for myself was learning that I'm trying to work with my nervous system, work with my body, with a collective goal of learning that we're actually safe, even though so much time has felt like it told me that we aren't, right? So we use this work to teach someone to slow down, take their foot off of the gas pedal of trying to get the answers or make this go away now. And by slowing down and taking your foot off of that gas pedal, maybe we give ourselves permission to pull that car over and take care of some of the like check engine lights and service lights that are popping up on the dashboard. And instead of trying to hurry up and get to the end result, by pulling the car over and taking care of what's showing up now, we learn that trying to get the answer of what's going on right now isn't the thing that's helping. What's actually going to help is giving ourselves permission to attend to those lights coming on. And by attending to that, we might uncover and see that what we're experiencing in our bodies just needed a little bit of attention. It needs a little bit of reprocessing, and it just needs this moment instead of trying to hurry up and figure out what's going on. Because the more that we hurry up, the more danger that we feel.
And just to kind of clear this up for listeners, just to like lay it out clearly, what is the kind of end goal of pain reprocessing therapy?
End goal is pain reduction or pain eradication. The biggest goal in pain reprocessing therapy is not to make pain go away and never come back. The goal is to change the way in which you respond. Extinction bursts, which is the burst of the behavior that you're trying to extinct, they happen. They happen because of stress. They happen because of a learned association in your brain. Right? They happen for so many different kinds of reasons, but what we do in pain reprocessing therapy is teach you to show up for any place that you're at, when you're feeling great, when you're not feeling great. Right? We're trying to use this work to get someone to change the way in which they respond, so that foundationally we know that our body is safe, we're working to trust it again. The sensations that we feel are signals being sent from the nervous system. And your nervous system's job is not to get it right, but it's just to protect you. Right? So by teaching someone all the core foundations of pain reprocessing therapy and giving them the actual tools to work through the discomfort that they're experiencing, right? It gives them something actually tangible to hold on to.
I love that approach, actually, to change the way you respond to pain, because recently I had like a big flare up of my old symptoms, but it was like, it didn't bother me in the slightest, because it was just like, oh, hello. Like the pain just doesn't, I don't know if that's making sense, but because I had changed the way I respond to those things, it wasn't a big deal like it would have been in the past. And that's because I've gathered those tools in the past. I think that's the most empowering thing you can do for someone.
It really is, because I hear you. Like, I think that the thing that always catches me up the most sometimes, because I feel the urgency because of my own journey, and because, you know, when you want to help someone, you really want to help, you want to get it right, and you want to make sure that they feel good, and you want it to work. And the biggest thing that kind of gets me caught up sometimes with my own clients is like, but I'm trying to make this go away. Like, I don't want to have to deal with this again, right? I don't want to have this come up. Or when it does come up, like, I'm doing something wrong. Like, the client will come to session, like, what am I doing wrong? I did everything right. I did all the work that you said to do, and it didn't work. And it's like, I know, but the goal is not to make it go away and never come back. You don't have that much control over your nervous system, and you don't have to. The goal is to change the way in which you respond. And that can feel so mind-boggling to someone who's, you know, often at the beginning of their recovery and just so desperate for an answer and a solution.
I think you get stuck in that. Yeah. It hurts. It's supposed to feel terrible. Like,
I know.
You
yeah,
do get stuck.
Absolutely.
There.
You do, especially when you're miserable and you've been searching for answers forever. The idea that it could come back and that you're supposed to change the way in which you respond doesn't feel comforting.
Not at all. So you've mentioned quite a few symptoms. You had the migraines, the IBS, the rashes.
Yep, I get hives. Mm-hmm.
Hives, yeah. So the name is obviously pain reprocessing therapy, yeah. But clear it up for us. What is pain reprocessing therapy for?
Yeah. If I could change it, now I love the original word. I think pain reprocessing therapy is great. But if I could change it and have it fit for a variety of people, what I do for my own clients is I say, well, let's change it to sensory reprocessing therapy. Right? Mm-hmm. I think that pain covers what gets us here in the first place. You know, like, it's intriguing, right? Like, how can we include pain in therapy? And the word reprocessing is really fascinating to people, because we can understand the gist of, like, are we changing our perception of it? That's interesting. I didn't know that was possible. I think it's a good word that catches a lot of people, because chronic pain, unfortunately, is very common amongst global population. But I think that sometimes, like, people are looking for that thing that identifies their experience. And so I have a lot of people that will reach out to the Pain Psychology Center and say, I don't know if this will work for me though, because I have like the smooth muscle condition. I have like a form of IBS, right? Or mine's kind of unique. I have this like plugged sensation in my ears all the time kind of sensation. Or someone else will say like, yeah, but my biggest sensation is like when my eye starts twitching, right? Or someone else will say like, my biggest sensation is like this really significant, like, cold sensation that I feel in, like, you know, the base of my thighs, and it's really dysregulating and it hurts to sit. It's all under the same umbrella, because you don't have a different part of your brain for things that you can see and can't see, or different part of the brain for something that shows up as head pain versus like lower back pain, right? Like the same part of your brain sends those signals, and it covers a wide range of symptoms, from no diagnosis to a full-blown diagnosis of fibromyalgia, right? There's a lot of coverage that pain reprocessing therapy covers. We just have to kind of be open to finding where we fit in. And so, yes, if I could change it, it would be sensory reprocessing therapy. That's no shade to Alan or the people that created it. I love it. I just like to do that for my own clients.
Yeah, I think about when they did the back pain study, and I go, why back pain? Come on, we could do something else. It's always back pain.
Always back pain. Always, I know, back pain gets a lot of attention. I know. I was joking with someone recently about that in a consultation group that I run, and they were commenting on how migraines and headaches.
Yeah, migraine would be a great one. Something neurological.
Right. And they were saying how, like, they were told, and their clients are always told, and this is something that I was also told, is that migraines are a medical mystery. And I'm like, oh, that would have been a great research for reprocessing therapy. And then someone else was like, I think people are just afraid to touch that one because they feel like there's so many other things that are at play as to what could influence a migraine. And as you know, as a migraine sufferer, there's so many things that people suggest to you to change. Mine was all the way down to like how tightly I wear my hair. And
oh, yeah, it's just cut my hair off at one point.
me too. I cut my hair very short. Absolutely. I am so with you. And I think it's growing, though. We have a few like research studies in the works, and it's changing over time, where we're seeing more and more that this is applicable to many different symptoms. But yes, I think initially, maybe researching it for back pain, I don't know, I'd have to ask. I wonder if it feels more, if it felt more like manageable. I don't know though. But they were really, difficult cases in the study. So it was great for a lot of people to feel seen by how complex those cases were.
Well, I would say though, if the goal is to change the way that you respond to the sensation, then really it could be applied to any sensation that you can think of.
Yeah. Absolutely. It really can. A couple of years ago, my partner and I were in a motorcycle accident. We usually ride separately, but on this day we rode together. And we got to the stoplight. We live in Los Angeles, so it's not the best place to be riding a motorcycle, but nonetheless. And someone pulled out of a stopped lane of traffic, hit us. We flipped 30 feet out into the intersection and broke a ton of bones. But my partner more than me. And he's never been injured before or been in a hospital for himself or been in an ambulance. And it was, of course, all of it at one time. And I started seeing the thing that I talk about all the time with clients. It's something called amplification of symptoms. And what that means is that when you're already to one degree really uncomfortable, something happened, right? So you're already like, let's say he was already, because of adrenaline, let's give him some wiggle room and say he was at like a 6 out of 10 in pain, right? But now, because there's fear of uncertainty, fear of how long he's going to be out for, fear if he's going to survive, right? Now we've attached a hearing aid and we've dialed it all the way up. So now he's getting it at like a 12 out of 10, right? And so what that when things like that happen, you really go into a state of panic. So he's like back at this ambulance and kind of like going into a low grade level of shock. His veins retracted. They couldn't get a vein in. He's shaking. He's like kind of incoherent. And that's scary for me because I was like, oh my gosh, something really bad is happening. But what was actually happening is fear is way up on top of already being in a lot of pain. And so what that tells us is that you can have something happening in your body because of an accident. Or clients that I have worked with have had the diagnosis of osteoarthritis, right? Rheumatoid arthritis. There is something going on structurally, but then now we have the extra component of the impact that your nervous system has on your body. And pain reprocessing therapy can still be helpful for those moments. So it's safe to say that I kind of tried to use pain reprocessing therapy throughout the time in which he was hurt and then recovering. He doesn't listen to me though, so I don't know if it like worked, but it was me trying to help. I don't know if it helped.
Sounds like me and my partner. You go, it's your nervous system, and he's like, ah,
yes. Like, shut up. Yeah,
it's like, predictive coding.
Absolutely. Leave me alone.
Okay. Okay, so I have a kind of question. So there seems to be kind of two main emphases, I don't know, in the mind-body kind of healing world. There's certain people emphasize, I guess, the idea of repressed emotions. And I would say the Pain Psychology Center more emphasizes the idea of being in the now and somatic tracking and attending to your sensations kind of differently. What is your take on the idea of repressed emotions?
So funny. I literally just had this conversation with a client before we got on today, because they asked me the same thing. I am in the middle. Don't get me wrong. I love The Body Keeps the Score. It's profound, right? Because what we're realizing is that you don't just like get to store away traumatic experiences and never feel them again. That's not how it works. You know, the brain is a beautiful system, but one that also makes sure that you remember when things have hurt you emotionally or physically and emotionally, right? It makes sure so that you protect yourself, right? That's why we feel triggered. Your brain's just saying, I'm just trying to help you so that you know that like, we don't like people like this, or we don't like things that smell like this, or we don't like places like this, right? Your brain's just making an effort to remind you we've been through something and I don't feel comfortable here. How we interpret it is sometimes what the problem is. But I love The Body Keeps the Score. I also can understand that it's not always an incredibly imperative, must happen part of the process where we have to like be an archaeologist and like dig up in order to actually heal, reprocess, and recover. I think it's a little bit of both. I have so many clients that literally have come to me and they're like, Vanessa, I don't have like big T trauma. I wasn't abused. My parents are safe, wonderful people. Our home was safe. Like, yes, there was a little bit of pressure in school, or I had like a really hard first breakup in high school, but I don't have like a big T trauma. Like, why do I have pain? Because they read like other books that reinforce that you might have some trauma, or learned that like there might be something hidden underneath the surface. And that is true for a lot of people, but I do have those clients that don't have those big experiences. And so what I like to acknowledge is that there's room in this work for everyone with the big T trauma or with little T trauma. It's really understanding that your brain's only job is just to keep you safe. How it keeps you safe is the problem that we're looking at. Some people are in a state of survival their entire lives and it catches up to them. And it's really important to recognize that they've probably been surviving since the age of 5. And that's what's showing up as pain in their body. But then other people, their brain might have just learned at some point in time that they started feeling uncomfortable and maybe they didn't know how to process it because things have been so great for so long. Right. And so their brain started telling their body, well, maybe this is dangerous because we've never felt this before. And so the signals kept coming. I think that repressed emotions are dependent on an individual person. This is what I enjoy about being a therapist, or what we have a lot of coaches at the Pain Psychology Center too, is that it makes room for everyone, depending on what their life experiences are, to say that like we can go there and absolutely make room for the necessary discussion around what emotions may be underneath the surface, anger, right? Sadness, even anxiety. Right. The example that I use with my client today is the person that's like, how are you? Oh, I just had like a really awful week, but I'm fine. That is repressed emotions. That's what we can look at a little bit more.
Yeah, I was just saying, not bad. Not bad, yeah. Not bad. It's not a lot. Okay. It could be worse.
Okay. Yeah, totally. Absolutely. Yeah. You could be fine and you can be not bad, but you can also be kind of pissed off that like someone stole your parking spot and then you dropped your phone and shattered the screen and then you're running late for a meeting. Like, that's aggravating. And we can talk about how to make space for those real experiences. But I think that like sometimes people are worried about what this process is supposed to look like for them. Mm-hmm. It's not supposed to look like anything. It's dependent on what your experiences are and what's important in your process of recovery.
Yeah, so I asked that question because for me, I was definitely I had to have that kind of cathartic release and get in touch with some of those emotional sensations again to get out of pain. I was recently listening to Lisa Feldman on a podcast. How Emotions Are Made, if you're familiar with her.
Yeah, absolutely.
She was talking about how when she had her back surgery, she had back surgery, she deliberately underdosed herself on pain relief so that she could feel her back, that her brain could feel her back healing. Because she was like, if I kept the pain relief going, then my brain would not feel my back healing. So then, like, she was like, I was worried I would end up with chronic pain. So I think it can be just as simple as that for people, that like they've had so much pain relief that they didn't feel it healing, and their brain has not registered that it's healed. So
absolutely,
but it's such a spectrum of,
such, you know, a spectrum.
Yeah,
it really is. It's so funny that you say that about your experiences too, because like I can relate on the total opposite end of that. Like my life experience has almost said, I need to learn how to freaking compartmentalize, because I was so swarmed by like so much trauma and so much feeling that I didn't know how to like do that and live life, that I ended up like just white knuckling it and powering through all the time because I didn't know how to carry all of this stuff.
Well, that, as I say, that kind of was me. I had numbed myself.
Okay.
I couldn't feel anything. I was numb. So that's why I had to kind of, in the process of healing.
Yeah. It's such a spectrum, like everything, you know. And I think that in the event that a clinician starts picking up on someone's repressed emotions, that it's important that that clinician like recognizes them, or the client makes sure to advocate them for themselves, just like my client did before we spoke today, where they asked me, do you think that I have a problem with repressed emotions? And I asked them, do you want me to be honest? And they said, yes, please. And I said, no, I think that you have a hard time compartmentalizing, actually, and knowing that like the fear that you felt back then is not the fear that needs to be present now. We have to know how to put that aside. And I jokingly said, like, I think that you could benefit from a little repression, but it was a joke, and we were kind of like cracking up a little bit. And this client was like, I think I actually could benefit from like jokingly telling myself like, oh, repress that, but not really, you know, being able to make some space for like, I think I feel things too much, and it's hard to know how to set some things aside. And it's such a spectrum. So I'm in the middle. I love the concept of the body keeping a score, the reality of the body keeping the score, and the reality of knowing like we also can focus on the here and now. I think it's a little bit of both.
It's a very safe answer. I'm in the middle, but
yeah,
I agree.
I know, right? I know, like Switzerland, just neutral in the middle. I'm not picking sides.
Okay, so what are the biggest barriers to healing for people?
The biggest barriers to healing are two things that I probably talk about the most. Like I've even posted about this on my therapy Instagram, and I talk about this with clinicians all the time and with clients. And these two things can branch off into so many different things. But I think the two things that are the biggest barriers are tone, T-O-N-E, the tone in which they do this work with, right? And their intention, right? So the tone can be with a sense of urgency, right? With a sense of intensity, right? Like if somebody is doing this work with a tone that just speaks volumes of trying to squeeze it to death, right? It took a lot of intensity and urgency to make this go away. The very things that are aimed at helping you, like somatic tracking, can be entirely weaponized, right? So I see this a lot in the beginning process with someone, especially since the information has grown over the years. Like I was here when there wasn't a lot of people
it's
that
grown
were,
a lot.
Oh my gosh, like I was here when there was nobody except like maybe Curable doing a podcast on this work. And now there's so many people that are talking about it. And when we didn't have any physicians or PTs or physios, osteos, and everyone, we didn't have anybody to really connect with outside of a small circle of people. Now we have so many people trained in this modality, knowing it more and more and utilizing it in their practices more. But it's interesting, you know, you want to get the information out there and you want people to know more about it. But I've actually seen a shift in people knowing more over time. When I first did the work, it was kind of frustrating, but I also felt like a magician because I was saying these things that people had never heard of before. But then now it's sometimes, and I hate to say it, it almost feels like people have too much information.
Yeah,
This
you
is
can
a
really,
particular,
yeah.
yeah, this is a particular population of people who are like playing Dr. Google to the umpteenth degree and utilizing every single resource possible to try to make this go away. That like now I'm almost feeling people with too much information. And so they'll come to their first session and be like, I read Alan's book and I listened to Curable and I listened to this podcast and I read this information and I'm trying to do all the things that I am absorbing and it's not working. And I'm like, oh, you're going to be so frustrated because when we start, I'm going to try to reduce how much you're doing and it's going to be so weird because you're like, but that's what I read though, that's the work that you do. I'm like, yeah, I know, but you're doing it with a lot of intensity and urgency. So the tone is the biggest thing, and the intention is another big part of the work. This is a big one because I have a lot of people asking, like, well, how many times a day do I do somatic tracking? And like, when do I do it? And like, do I journal or not? And like, what else I should I be absorbing to like make this work? And like, and I will ask clients, well, do you want to? And it's such a perplexing question. Every time they're like, well, what do you mean? I'm like, do you want to read that thing? Or do you want to do somatic tracking multiple times a day? Or do you want to journal? Do you want to? What is your intention behind asking me that question? And 9 times out of 10, I will have a client say, no, I don't want to be doing any of this at all. Like, I don't want to be in pain. Like, rightfully so. Everything that you're saying that you need to do, have to do, should be doing, it sounds so rigid and forced, lacking fun in your life, maybe even lacking a sense of like ease and lightness. And that's what somatic tracking is an exercise to get you to look at things through a lens of curiosity and lightness and ease. And Dr. David Clark, who is the president of the Psychophysiologic Disorder Association, the PPDA, he talks all the time about individuals experiencing chronic pain. It's imperative to prioritize fun and pleasure in your life, because a lack of fun equals a rigid and structured personality, and a rigid and structured personality is going to look at things through a rigid and structured lens. And so that's a really hard one for clients to adapt to, because for them, as you know, they're just in pain and just want to do everything possible to get out of pain. But if we're not making any room for things that you actually want to do, like I said in the beginning, as Christy says, you won't know the moment that you get out of pain, but that comes with giving yourself permission to get out of everything that you are doing to make yourself get out of pain, right? When we're so preoccupied with getting out of pain, the only thing that we're going to see is the pain. So tone and intention, those are the two biggest, hardest lessons, hurdles, the most powerful ones when you navigate through them, really important parts of the process.
Big lesson for a type A, I'm going to do all the things. Personality. Side question. If we're talking about kind of rigid, structured, type A, big feeling type people, do you, this, you may not know the answer, but do you tend to see a lot of neurodivergent people in your clinic? Do you think they're overrepresented in this population?
I think that neurodivergent individuals are absolutely present in this population of clients, and I don't think that all the modalities are aimed to work for them. I have neurodivergent people in my life that are the loves of my life, the closest people to me. And the reality is that like somebody who is beautifully neurodivergent might not have the same ability to be introspective in the way that mindfulness calls for. Right. So it's a little bit more challenging to like engage in a state of mindfulness when that's just not how your brain is wired. There's this one podcast that I listen to. I can't remember the name of it, but in the episode, the two individuals that were talking to each other, one of them was like, I'm introspective. When I go to the grocery store, I'm like thinking about like what I'm doing next week, whether or not I want to have kids, I have to get rice, like all these different things are kind of going through the mind. And the other host was like, I'm not introspective. She's like, well, when you go to the grocery store, what do you think of? She's like, that I have to get rice. And she's like, the whole time? She's like, yeah. And I get the rice. And if there's nothing else on my list, I don't get it. I just get what I get. And then I check out and go home and make dinner. And the gal was like, what? You don't think about like existential crisis kinds of like moments of like so many different things. And she's like, no, because that's not where I'm at. I'm at the grocery store. And they asked each other, I can't remember which one, but one of the girls asked the other, if you were a household appliance, like anything in a household, what would you be? And the non-introspective gal said, I would be the video surveillance camera on the front of the home. Because I don't move and focus on something unless it comes into my focus. And then I follow it until it's out of focus, and then I'm back to kind of just being. And the other gal who is introspective was saying, I am a washing machine, but like you've tossed all the colors into the same cycle and it just goes and washes all together and blends into one another. And I asked this question to a client once, if you were a home appliance, which one would you be? And my client said, I am a slow cooker. I just marinate on one thing until it all falls apart. And I loved that. So I was like, there's so many different ways in which our brains are wired and the way that we look at things and how we operate. And I think sometimes mindfulness work doesn't always fully include maybe more like non-introspective people. And non-introspective people are the neurodivergent people. And I think that there's definitely a lot of ways in pain reprocessing therapy and all of us clinicians at the Pain Psychology Center that are really good at getting creative with PRT so that it works for everyone. It just takes, just like changing it from pain reprocessing to sensory reprocessing, it just takes someone to tell you that this will work for you and that we'll get creative together. For it to actually be workable for you. So we have clients that are neurodivergent, but I could see why it might be hard for someone who is neurodivergent absorbing the material on their own, having a hard time feeling like they can actually do this work.
Actually, my friend has ADHD and she has no ability to visualize anything in her head.
That's really common. Very, very common that someone has the difficulty of visualizing. I've had many clients that are like, nope, I can't do that. That doesn't work for me. Totally fine. There's other ways that we can navigate this. There's not one way. Yeah, it's very common, actually.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think the great thing is there are so many different tools out there for everyone.
Yeah, absolutely.
I hated the journaling. Couldn't stand it. Didn't work for me.
Not for me.
Yeah. No. Meditation, yeah. It was game changer.
Yeah. Absolutely. When I got out of grad school, when I was in my frenzy of trying to fix how I was feeling, I bought this gratitude journal. Oh, I still have it. It's right here. I bought this gratitude journal before I graduated. I was like, when I graduate, I'm going to write in it. I'm going to be grateful. I'm going to practice my gratitude journal. And like a true type A person, I like made sure to like kind of organize it into my day. And then I started like slipping off and I was like, well, if I put it on my nightstand, I'll do it when I wake up. And I did it for a little bit. And then I started kind of like slipping off of that. And I was like, well, I'll do it right before bed. And then I would like fall asleep because I'd be so exhausted. And then before you know it, this gratitude journal became this like super negative symbol of me being lazy and unattentive and all these mean things. And then I was like, I don't think that gratitude is supposed to feel this way. So what I did is I just put it in my bookcase. I was like, I'll touch it whenever I do. And every time I switch out my books, I'm a bibliophile. I collect books that I don't read. And so I have a library in my home, and then it's comforting, right? So every time I'm ready to switch out a book, I'll switch it out. And if I want to, I'll take out the gratitude journal. And that's once every like month or two, maybe. And I'll look at it, maybe I'll write in it, but there's no pressure, because just because I don't write in it doesn't mean I'm not processing gratitude. Just maybe not in that way.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah. Okay, so we're approaching the hour, so we might start to wrap up. I have a few closing questions.
Yeah, absolutely.
So this is my closest. What's something you wish you'd heard or understood early on in your healing journey that you could share with listeners?
Something that I wish I heard early on. Gosh, I feel like I wish I would have heard in the beginning that it's not about constantly telling yourself that you're safe. It's about recognizing that sometimes your brain works really well, in fact, too well. And it's been in a mode of feeling unsafe for so long that we can say that right now, in this moment, I might be physically safe, but maybe because of my life experiences, I don't feel emotionally safe. Like, I wish someone would have told me the difference, because it's really easy to invalidate yourself and to be like, you're being ridiculous, like nothing's happening. I'm like, yeah, but as you know, like, you've been through a lot. And when you've gone through a lot, it's really hard to sit in the silence of things and to not feel like something is wrong.
Yeah.
I wish someone would have told me that, like, this is just the comfort and the chaos. The only reason that I am uncomfortable here is because I've been so used to being in a state of survival and chaos that my brain actually needs to learn that the quiet and the calm of things is safe for you. I just kept telling myself, but you're safe, you're safe, you're safe, you're safe. And I just felt so much worse. And so what I do with my own clients and what I do with myself is create your own realistic messages of safety, right? Mine was like, you're allowed to say no. And it could mean with anyone and with anything. But like, that was my message of safety. I'm allowed to say no. It's okay if people feel disappointed in me. It's okay if people get mad at me, but I'm allowed to say no. And that was my message of safety and a few others. But I think it's important to know that you can create your own messages of safety. I am safe may not work for you, and that's okay. And it might not work for you because sometimes we have to make space for the fact that we don't feel emotionally safe, even though we're physically out of that situation.
Yeah, mine was, I'm safe in this body. So it's more about like my body, isn't it? You know, because you're right. Sometimes you are not emotionally safe.
Absolutely.
Okay, so I'm going to throw this one in there. If you could be a house appliance, what would you be?
If I could be a house appliance, my answer would be that I'd be a blender. Like, I truly would. I am that person that you put all of these ingredients together and they might not make sense, but once they're fully blended and immersed together, it might kind of taste okay. That's how my brain works, I feel like, and that's how my body works. I'm like saying and doing a lot of things at one time, but I'm trying to remind myself it makes sense, I promise. Just let me finish and then we'll get to the end result, and I think it'll make sense. It might not taste like amazing, but it'll be fine. It'll, once it's all blended together. I think I'm a blender. That's just, I don't think I necessarily, like a washing machine, I was like, I understand that, but then you can still separate things at the end and still dry them separately and overthink it. But I think I'm a blender. Everything's fast and quick and puts it all into one little quick cycle. But it should taste okay at the end.
You're like spinach in a smoothie.
There we go. Exactly.
Seems like it wouldn't make sense, but it all goes together.
Yep.
Okay, so do you usually have, okay, so I know you tell people to do less, but your top three kind of resources or things that you recommend to clients?
My top resources, meaning like words of guidance or
Anything, just anything.
okay. They all kind of go hand in hand, but my top one is loosen your grip. I have a lot of exercises that I will utilize with a client to loosen their grip. And what I mean by that is, recovery and pain and figuring out everything that's going on with you. It's like sand in the palm of your hand. You care about it, you scoop it up, and all this sand in the palm of your hand, you don't want to lose. Right. But the tighter that you squeeze, the more sand that you lose, and at a faster pace. You have to loosen your grip, and you're going to lose some of it in the process, but tightening your grip won't help you contain it anymore. It just helps you lose more control. Right. Like you can't force something to go away or force yourself to figure something out, or like I was saying earlier, like force yourself to relax. You have to loosen your grip. Right. And so what that takes us into is the next thing that I tell people is to be this observer in the aquarium. Now, I can't take credit for that. One of our clinicians, Christine, at the Pain Psychology Center said that during a PRT training once, and I just latched onto it because I used to go to the aquarium with my grandmother when I was a kid, and it was like my favorite thing to do. And it was so peaceful, like sitting on the other side of this glass wall that was floor to ceiling, 2 to 3 feet thick. And you feel like you're in the water sometimes because you're so close to the glass, especially when something swims at you that's kind of scary. It makes you feel like you need to back up. But if you just remind yourself that you don't have to get in there and wrangle it and you don't have to run from it, you can play the role of this observer that just notices that things can come and go. It can ebb and flow. You don't have to control it all. Right? So loosen your grip. Right. Be this observer in the aquarium. And I think the last one, honestly, would really be like make sure to prioritize a sense of joy. Like you're allowed to enjoy yourself and your life, even if you're in pain. You know that like you are allowed to have pleasure. You are allowed to have fun. It doesn't feel like you can because we're in so much pain and oftentimes we're so distracted by it all, and I get that, but you are allowed to have fun. We don't have to wait until everything is better to start enjoying ourselves. We can start working on that now. I heard a quote once that said, happiness is a vacation destination. You don't get to live there. You have to work to get there. And I loved that because it was a reminder that like even feeling uncomfortable, like you're not going to be here forever. Right. But we have to know how to balance working on our recovery, even when we're feeling unwell, and making room for moments of joy, no matter how small, whether it's a show, a song, right, or a moment where we just like stay in the shower for a little bit longer because it's a way to not have to go out into the world and take on all the responsibilities. Right. So those would be the three things that I would say.
Those are all really good. On that last one, making room for moments of joy, I actually think that can be really hard if you've lived in survival for a long time.
Oh, yeah. And that's why I throw that in there because I think that it feels like a feels like a really big process to
It
prioritize
is,
that when
yeah.
you're miserable because it is, and it's still just as important as getting out of pain.
Okay, wonderful. That's great. I might try Baki last, very last question. I heard this on the Huberman Lab podcast this morning, actually. Last thing, what are you most excited about at the moment to leave us with?
Yeah, well, the most exciting thing is that I actually have a PRT workbook coming out in the summer. So
Ooh.
I know I'll have to keep you in the loop. It's a publishing deal that was presented to me from New Harbinger, and my co-author, who I actually get to meet tonight for the first time ever, even
Ooh.
like in person, like body to body. She is an incredible clinician from not from she's from the US but or from California, sorry, but she lives in Alaska. Her name is Olivia Sineko. She works at a tribal health organization for Alaskan natives and non-natives, and she manages their pain program. And we just connected through this work and bonded and kind of speak the same language and are quirky and weird and use a lot of analogies and and we just liked each other. And so we just thought of creating something just to create it. And then it just so happened that this opportunity presented itself, and we were like, why not? And we took it up and it all went through, and our final manuscript is due pretty soon here. Gotta get through some edits and then submit it. So yep, this PRT workbook should be coming out. I believe marketing's going to be happening soon, but it should be out by summer, early fall of 2024.
Congratulations. I look forward to reading it.
Thank you. Absolutely. I think it'll be a good tool of a lot of the things that we talked about, where we're just saying, like, we have to give ourselves permission to loosen our grip. I know that we want to get out of pain, but the urgency and the intensity and the I have to won't help you.
Perfect. Well, it's been so lovely talking with you today. Thank you
You
so much
too.
for helping spread the word, the good word.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. Thank you.
Just going to stop the recording now.